Do you have a favorite Concord song, or at least a song that you enjoy the most, like playing live or off the album?
I really love playing The Most Beautiful Girl in the Room live. I it's so fun to play. And then the recording, I'm super fond of Mother Uckers. I remember we recorded that in New York, and I remember Jimmy Carr, I'm pretty sure he'd popped past a visit. He's a friend of ours, he was in New York, and he came by the studio to visit, and we just figured out that bass line on the synth. And it was, I feel like Mother Uckers is a really, really banging recording, actually. That's my favorite recording.
Hey, everyone. I'm Billy, and welcome back to Half the Picture. I'd like to wish everyone watching a Happy New Year, and also to say how thrilled I am at our guest for this episode, who is none other than Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords. Now, I've been a fan of Brett's music since I was a kid. I mean, I told you I was freaky. The second Flight of the Conchords album was actually the second album I ever bought. I was such a huge fan of the Conchords, and then later on his solo work, you know, things like Songs Without Jokes and his most recent album, Freak Out City, which he just toured. I was such a huge fan of that stuff too, and I just couldn't wait to get him on the podcast to chat to him about it. Brett and I dived right down the rabbit hole in this conversation and touched on all sorts of areas, from the upcoming reunion show of Flight of the Conchords happening in the summer to the legacy of the Conchords themselves, as well as his work in Hollywood on films like The Muppets and on Lord of the Rings as well, his cameo in Lord of the Rings. And we also found time, of course, to touch on his latest tour for Freak Out City. By the way, remember to like and subscribe to the podcast, as it really helps us get more amazing guests like Brett onto the show. So without further ado, let's roll on my conversation with Brett McKenzie. Enjoy.
Hi, Brett. Welcome to Half the Picture. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. I've been a fan of yours since I was a kid, since back in the Concours days. So no, this was such a pleasure to have you on.
And
yeah, and I guess we're currently calling from it's 8 p.m. London time now. And how do we find you? Morning in Wellington?
Breakfast. Yeah, it's morning time. Just got a cup of coffee. Ready to roll. Yeah, yeah. So thanks for staying up. Yeah.
No, our pleasure. Our pleasure. So I'm curious to ask about what you've had lately, I suppose, because I guess the main thing being the tour for your latest album, Freak Out City, which I actually have a copy of here, which I picked up when you came to London recently on the tour. You came and did a little gig in Rough Trade West.
Yeah, in London. So fun. So I've just got home from a sort of medium tour, I guess kind of a small tour really, but a tour with my band. I've got this giant 8-piece band and toured that record in LA, New York, Washington and London, and then came back home. And yeah, just going to do some shows in New Zealand, Australia coming up next, yeah.
Fantastic. And the new album, it seems to me, has gone down really, really well. And the new material on it, you know, in the live performances you've been giving, people seem to have really taken to it. I mean, what was the reception like when you were doing your tour?
People are into it, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, the show, you know, I've got these new songs that aren't particularly comedy songs, but the show ends up being pretty funny and I can't help myself, you know, gagging around with the audience. And so the show, even though it has songs that aren't necessarily comedy songs, the show itself, the live show, is a real mixture of comedy and music. I get someone out of the audience and write a song with them sometimes. You know, like, so I ask some of the audience to tell me a story about their life, and then on stage turn that into a song, and the band jumps on, and suddenly, almost like magic, before the audience's eyes, a song appears out of nowhere. And usually people's stories are pretty ridiculous. The London stories, curiously, were really dark. Like, I'd just come across America and people's stories were like, oh, I met someone, or oh, we broke up. And in London, I was like, well, you got any ideas? And the first night, someone in London goes, there was a stabbing in the park. And I was like, okay, yes. And then, any other ideas for a song? And then the next night, the idea was, I had a friend and they fell in love with, they met someone and it turned out they were a Nazi. That was
that. Oh my God.
Yeah. It felt like we'd come back to the 1930s or something. So yeah, it was London had really dark ideas for songs. It was quite curious. But anyway, it ended up being really funny. It was great. But yeah,
yeah, that British dryness, I guess, is which we're... Which
really,
we're
it was very for. Dry, very dry.
Well, I was wanted to ask about that specifically because I'd heard that you'd been doing this. So it was an idea that you'd road-tested on the previous tour you'd done for Songs About Jokes, your first album, solo album.
Yeah, and then I tried it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, then you wanted to take it on the road again and sort of and I guess involving the audience really viscerally, which was something that I saw you do a fair bit of as well when you played Rough Trade West, which I came along to see. You were really involving the audience and you were enjoying the kind of the back and forth, it seemed to me, a lot with the audience.
Yeah, and maybe that's from doing comedy. I like the connection with the audience. I like the audience to be kind of a little bit just keeping them awake and keep them alive, you know, keep them on edge a little bit. Like when you start talking to someone in the audience and say you're going to write a song, the whole crowd just suddenly goes, oh no, what's going to happen here? Oh, and you can feel the whole room get nervous but excited. Yeah, so I did it in New Zealand and it's very stressful because as a performer, you're like, oh, sometimes it doesn't work because the person's story is crazy or just doesn't seem to quite get it to work. And I've got this band of musicians all standing around behind me looking at me like, what are you doing? The first time I did it, I didn't tell the band I was going to do it. I just started doing it on stage and they were like, what are you doing? What's happening? And then I'm at the piano and I start writing a song and the band are really great musicians. So they can just quickly jump on and get the chords. And then I'm like, okay, what about a horn line? Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And then they start doing it and then the backing vocals and quickly it turns into a big song. But it is very stressful. I said to my wife, I was like, oh, I don't know if I can keep doing it. It's so harrowing, you know, because on tour you end up being quite tired generally. And so, but at the same time, it's so exciting. And it often ends up being kind of the highlight of the show because it goes from such chaos and unknown. And if the song does work, if you do get a song that works, it's really exhilarating, even for the band and for me to play. So yeah, it's kind of cool. It makes it kind of different from any other gig. Yeah,
and I guess as you say, it keeps you on your toes too because you can't just be safe in the knowledge that you're just playing the same set every night. There has to be a change if you're involving the audience in that sort of improvisational way. And I guess I was curious to ask, like, you, because like I say, you did a sort of a medium sized tour. You played Washington and New York and LA as well as, you know, several places in New Zealand and London a couple of nights. Like, what were the most memorable stories? It sounds like, I mean, some of the London ones must be in the running. I mean, quite dark energy. Like, what were some of the memorable things you heard from the audience?
There was one in New York where a guy started talking. I'm trying to remember exactly how he said it up. But he said, he's like, oh, I met someone and we got together. And I was like, oh, okay, great. How'd it happen? He's like, well, we've known each other for quite some time. We were texting. And then he revealed, oh, we've been texting for about 7 months. And I was like, oh, well, that's a long time texting before you went on your first date. And then he goes, oh, well, yeah, that's because they were in a relationship. and then he goes, and so was I. And then you watch the whole audience just go like, oh, dude. And then he's like, no, it was just friendly texts. Just we men were just friendly texts for 7 months while he was in a relationship. And anyway, it just was amazing watching the audience like him, you know, like, oh, he's a guy, he's met someone. To, oh, whoa, that doesn't sound like you'd manage that very well to the end. Anyway, that was interesting. But the ones, like one of the first ones, first time we did it was in Whanganui in New Zealand, a sort of small town. And the woman was, the stories are always really interesting. She was like, this, her partner left her with two kids, five chickens. There were often stories about people leaving them. And one in Auckland, the woman goes, the idea was fallen out of love, right? So she's like, and I said, oh, okay, so where's your partner? Have you broken up? And she goes, oh, no, he's right here. He's here.
Oh, God.
Yeah, oh, crap. You've got like 700 people, they go, oh, no.
And is that the moment where you as a musician are just like on stage, you're like, you start rubbing your hands like, okay, I can make this into a song. Like, well, I can do this.
It ended up being like a sort of Diana Ross disco track. It was quite cool, but it's very funny. Like it's always interesting. Like, and it's kind of, what's weird is it's like my job writing for films. So I'm, you know, often they like say, write a song about something. And I'm looking for what might be interesting for the song. And so as people are telling me their stories, it's really similar job. He's like, what would make a good chorus, or is something that is that a verse idea? Or, and people keep talking, and the more people talk, the more, I don't know, it's often the funnier it gets, the more personal the details get. Yeah,
like that is like there comes a certain point where they can't stop, and it kind of all comes tumbling out. And
yeah, and sometimes you don't realize what's funny about your own story, you know.
For sure. I mean, you mentioned the sort of the movie work you've done, which I guess has been a strong theme in your career for the last 15 years. I mean, going back to the Muppets, which, yeah, of course, you know, you famously won an Oscar for your work on the Muppets, the first Muppet movie from, well, I guess I say the first, but like the first of the new wave of Muppet movies.
New Muppet movie, but it's called the Muppet movie, I think. Called the Muppets, so it's slightly confusing. Yeah.
Aye, and then Muppets Most Wanted after that. And having been a fan of yours for a long time, and having listened of your solo work, your new solo work, and then also going back to the Concords days, Fight the Concords, your band with Jermaine Clement, listening to your solo work, having obviously since you've had that extraordinary career working in film and on television writing songs, it's interesting to me, to my ear. Like I feel like I can hear a shift maybe in the sort of in the work that you're doing, like, you know, in the on the solo records. There's a lot of bombast, there's a lot of, you know, I love the bands that you use and the session musicians that you use on the records. There's a lot of, I'd say, a lot of bombast, there's a lot of brass, you know, and it's got this great almost kind of show tune sound, kind of like in reminiscent of Randy Newman and kind of Steely Dan, and like the new records, no exception, Freak Out City, which I loved. And I guess something I wanted to ask, just as you mentioned the film work, how do you think working in Hollywood and working on films has influenced the approach to songwriting and, I guess, crafting an album in the studio that you've done on Songs About Jokes and Freak Out City? How do you think working in Hollywood has influenced you in that regard?
Huge influence, because when I started doing the film songs, which is really the Muppet stuff, before that, like with Concords, the songs, when we recorded the songs for Concords, it was me and Jermaine in the studio with Mickey Petralia as the producer. We're just playing everything, you know, I'm playing all the instruments and playing a lot of the instruments, and then it's all kind of super lo-fi and little drum machines and little ideas. And that's kind of awesome, because in the smallness of the recordings, that was always what was quite funny about Concords, was us on two acoustic guitars, trying to rock out like we're a big band, or like we're a hip hop act, or it is dun, dun, ching, dun, dun, ching. We're acting like it's a full stadium gig. And then when I started doing the film work, the Muppet stuff, that was the first time I've worked in these big Los Angeles studios, and that's just where films work. That's just their normal studios. So got to go to this place called Ocean Way, which is also called United, and it's on Sunset Boulevard. There's a bunch of classic old rooms, and you walk in, and the walls are lined with gold records from just for decades of gold records. Okay. And then because it's these film projects, you're on these really tight schedules. You've got to record all these songs in 2 days or whatever. And so they hire the best musicians, these session musicians, who I'd heard of, but I'd never met them. But they show up, and the guitar player shows up, a truck pulls up full of guitars, right? And then a guy loads in all these guitars. And it's not the guitar player. There's 100 guitars in these big crates. And the musicians, they all come in, and you give them the charts. You say, okay, this is the song. You play the sort of demo, and you're like, this is what we're trying to do. And then they go in and they play it once, and it sounds better than anything I've ever played. And then you have a couple of little notes like that, but it's got to go a bit faster, or it's, you know, adjust that bit. And then two or three times, and then you've got the song recorded. So they're completely different to me and Jermaine sitting in a room for 10 hours going ding ding ching. Well, hang on, try that again, ding ding ching, you know. And then so really it was so exciting to experience that for me. There were so many parts about it that were blowing my mind. And the musicians are all, what's funny is a lot of them are in their 60s and now probably in their 70s, and they've been session musicians for a long time. And they stand in, you know, those hallways with the gold records I was describing. And, you know, you have a tea break, cup of tea break, and they stand in the hallway going, I played on that one. I did that one. Yeah, I did that one. They all played on all the records. It's so crazy. They all played on all the LA records. And, wow. You know, and the people they're playing with are just like Michael Jackson, you know, Aretha Franklin. They played, it's the Doobie Brothers. They play with all these crazy players, you know. And seeing that process and how they record. Mickey, who was the producer who'd worked on Concords, who did all the Muppet stuff as well, and has done my albums with me, we thought, wow, we should try doing some music with these guys, like do an album like this that's not for film, but just, but we could do an album in like 3 days. These guys are so fast. You could just like go in, done. And so we're like, okay, let's do it. And I said to Lee Sklar, who's this legend bass player who looks, if you look him up, he played on everything, and he plays James Taylor and he tours with Phil Collins, and he's played lots and lots of people who played with Dolly Parton, 9 to 5. He played that song, and just you go through the list of songs they've played, like the music, the musician's IMDb type thing, and it's crazy, but lovely, lovely guy. And I was telling him, oh, I'm thinking about doing some music, and he goes, oh, I'm keen. And then all the band were like, I'm keen. They were keen to do it. So the band were keen, and we booked the studio, and I wrote a bunch of songs. And hilariously, do you know that guy, John Bryan? He does the music for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's an LA, great LA musician.
Amazing.
Eternal Sunshine and Spotless Mind. He did the score to that. He does Fiona Apple stuff. And I met him in LA, and I was talking to him. I said, oh, yeah, we're going to record an album in 3 days. And he just. He just started laughing at me. He was like, oh, yeah. And then to his credit, 2 years later, I finished the album, you know. Because like, you get you record the tracks, the rhythm, but then you have so much more work to do. I just didn't really quite comprehend how much you adjust things and vocals and all the fixing and changing. And yeah, anyway, very funny. My initial idea of like, I'm going to record an album in 3 days was a bit of a dream.
Well, I guess that mentality of, as you say, like coming to the studio with the guys, with the musicians, and bash it out. I mean, that is quite an old fashioned, I think, these days mentality. I mean, because people spend so much time on albums, there's almost because they have all the time in the world, I guess, to get it right and to produce it right and to make sure, you know, the mix is correct and everything and proper. And you think back to like the 70s when like Bowie, who I know you're a big fan of, was recording Ziggy Stardust and Chidori. He was bashing some of those records out, like Transformer as well, with Lou Reed, in like 2 weeks. They would record the whole thing, and it was like, and yeah. I remember
that was like London, right? That's London with the session musicians who came in, doom doom doom, and all that.
Yeah.
And it's a really different process. And the thing is, the musicians are, it's a different type of musician. Like a lot of those musicians grew up playing in bars, playing gigs every night, and then they record every day. They play the whole song in one go. Sorry, I was trying to do a. Like that. Now it's much more common to play pieces of music, little bits of a song, and do you know what I mean? It's like a different style of playing, and I guess back at that time you couldn't, studios were super expensive, and now people can edit at home on their computers and tidy things up, whereas you couldn't do that, so you just had to get it right immediately. Or you also left these things that were kind of not quite right, but no one, that was also quite cool. Yeah.
Well, that despite the fact that, as we say, like, you know, you went into the studio with the idea, okay, let's do this in 3 days, and then it took longer than that. I mean, the thing is, when you listen back to Freak Out City, which I have done, you know, many times in the run up to this interview, and just generally because I'm a huge fan of it, you feel that infectious energy still in the record. Like there are so many, you know, great songs on there, like, you know, that I love, like Eyes on the Sun, and you know, Shouldn't Have Come Here Tonight, and you know, there's so many great tracks on it, which you really get that sense of spontaneity and sort of infectious energy. I think that for me is a theme that runs through all of your work, but particularly on this one, there's a real sense of warmth and joy to the music.
Yeah,
and
I was I was trying to get that feeling of the musicians in the room playing together, like that Shouldn't Have Come Here Tonight, which I think came out, that the rhythm on that is pretty cool. Like that's a funny story. Lee, the bass player, was talking about. So also he's such a character. He plays his electric bass, and he has this. Often the producer is, you know, behind the window saying, can you change the sound or can you try something different? He's got a switch on his bass that he switches. He's like, yeah, I'll try this. And he switches it. And the switch doesn't even connect it to anything. It's just because then they go, yeah, that sounds great. And then he's also got another switch which lights a little LED, which is like flipping the bird, a picture of a little flipping the bird in his bass. He's such a funny guy. He's got a book, actually. Wherever he goes, he meets people, takes photos of them flipping the bird, and he's got a book of photos of him over decades with people, all famous musicians and people all over the world flipping the bird. But on that track, we were recording it, he'd put on this weird bass effect sound on the sort of, it's like a sort of octave-y chorusy thing, and into the bass, instead of going, instead of sounding like dum do do boom 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 boom, it goes sort of, that's exaggerated, but something like that. And weirdly, we didn't notice at first because you're kind of busy listening in the room, like trying to get things right, get the, you know, drum sounding right. And we're listening back, and and then Daryl, who's the engineer, and Mickey, your producer, are like, "What's that? What's up with the bass sound?" And then, but they're too scared. Everyone's too scared to tell Lee to change it because he's such a kind of legend. Anyway, so like, Brett, you got to tell him to change it. It sounds crazy. And so then I was like, Lee, do you mind redoing the bass without that pedal that he'd just put on, he'd snuck on? And he was like, okay. So he goes in and replays the bass over the top, overdubs it. And then we have a clean bass part. And then 6 months later when we're mixing it, we're like, that sounds good, but it's lacking a sort of energy. And then we put back on his original one with the crazy effect. And oh yeah, that's awesome. And it ends up being like the key part of the song. And you finish the track when you track something and everyone comes in and listens. It's interesting watching these amazing players, you know, because you can, if they're there going like nodding along, then you it's a good sign. Do you know what I mean?
You're on something.
They think it's good. You're like, okay, we're good. If they think it's good, then we're probably fine.
It gets the thumbs up, not the flipping the bird. It gets the thumbs up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you're playing that song live, then is that something that you try and replicate? I mean, like, with like, okay, let's try and get a bit of a pedal on there, like, on that song in particular. Like, shouldn't have come
tonight. Yeah. Well, live, Jackie is the bass player live. She's from Wellington. And yeah, so we got this cool pedal and she had that for that track. It's funny, it's quite hard to get that track. To play that track live, it's interesting because it's something about the way the feel in the studio. We got something. Some tracks are easy to play live, and some are tricky to get them to sit in the pocket. Yeah.
And with the album, then, because as I say, comparing it to say to Songs About Jokes, your first solo album, which I guess I remember at the time you saying that like you were explicitly going, because obviously at that point you were known for Flight of the Conchords with Jermaine and your work in Hollywood on films like The Muppets, which I guess are broadly, you know, a comedic. And
yeah,
then with that.
Yeah.
And then on that album, you were like, right, we're going in the other direction here. We're going to go, even though maybe there is some of your sort of your inherent humor in there, it's like, this is explicitly, we're going in another direction here. The songs are more sort of somber. They're more, in fact, listening back to it, it's quite a melancholy album tonally. It's a beautiful album, but it's quite melancholy. And
it is quite sad. I think it's, I was spending a little bit too much time in Los Angeles by myself. And it's quite a desolate, lonely city. My family was in New Zealand and I'd be working there quite a lot, and I do remember, and I was reading the news a lot, which you know, if you read the news and you write songs, they tend to be quite bleak.
Yeah, and it was in COVID as well, wasn't it? You were recording
just
writing those songs,
yeah, leading up into COVID and through COVID. It's pretty sort of dark times. And it was interesting. I realized afterwards this album, I was like, oh man, I want to just make something that's a bit more playful, and not, I wasn't trying to, this the new record, I'm not trying so obsessively to be not funny. And at first when I did this first solo record, I thought, oh, this is something different. And the second one, now it's all starting to feel kind of like the same thing to me, like writing a song for a film or writing a song for my record. It's starting to be more in the same zone, which I think is a good thing. It's just, I just write the song, and if it's about something that's funny, that's good. If it's about something that's heartfelt or emotional, that's fine as well. It doesn't, and just sort of let them all happen at the same time, if that makes sense. Yeah, I'm not kind of trying to steer it as much. But when I get hired on a film job, more often than not, I tend to come in to kind of make something funny, is, you know, when it's a song, trying to bring some lightness, or if it's a dramatic moment. I think the Sherman brothers, who are the songwriters who worked for Disney for years and did did like Mary Poppins and Jungle Book, famously they got brought in and said, can you, I think they even had songs for that and it was just too dark. So they said, can you just, Walt Disney said, the Sherman Brothers, can you just write some songs for this that are fun? That's sort of the zone I get that I work in for films, where I bring some lightness and some humor to any situation in a song. even if it's a, you know, an emotional moment, try and find little pieces of lightness in there. I worked with Michelle Hazavinicius. We were working on a film for Disney for a while. It never got made. It's this funny movie called Bob the Musical that's been in development for about 20 years, and everyone in Hollywood's worked on it. every songwriter's had a go at it, and lots of any director who's even vaguely adjacent to music or musicals has had a go at it. And we spent 6 months working on it, and it never gets there. It's like a cursed project. It's hilarious. But he said something kind of interesting, which I thought was, he was talking about when you're working on a comedy, you know, there are moments when you don't want to put jokes. If it gets to a moment that's like an emotional moment, it's tempting to put a really silly joke right there and throw it all away because, you know, you got emotion heightened. But he said there are times you don't want a joke. You just got to let the emotion live there. I thought that was really, I loved that. I thought that was a really clear way of figuring out how to get, you know, because comedies sometimes they lack connection. And I think often that's because people just throw in too many jokes around the bits we actually need to connect with the story. Yeah.
Because that's what you're doing with comedy or drama or any genre, isn't it? You're telling a story and, you know, you want that story to have a sense of stakes and sincerity, I guess, about when it matters. You want to know when to hit the audience with a joke, with humor, and then when to actually draw them in.
And I think for a film, it was really interesting. I think, so now I'm working on a couple of films at the moment that are actually full musicals. They're animated films. And so these ones, I'm the songwriter for the whole film. Some of the songs are ridiculous, you know, big comedy songs and things. But some of them actually need to be, there's just, you know, the character gets lost and it's a Christmas movie and it actually needs to, it's not really going to be a comedy song that, it's just got to be a heartfelt song at that point, yeah.
Well, I remember you saying about when you were writing Man and Muppet, which, as I say, you know, was, I guess, the big hit from the Muppets movie, which won you your Oscar. And I remember you describing the songwriting process of just like how you approached it was just like, this is like an incredibly emotional, heartfelt power ballad. But it just happens to be about a man who, you know, and a Muppet, you know, and it's and the relationship between the two.
Yeah, that combination is with... you get a lot of great comedy out of that. But at the time when I'm sitting at the piano going, am I a man? I mean, I'm just digging in. Like, you keep singing, you know, I love that song, you know, Harry Nilsson. I can't live if living is without you. I mean, it's like, am I? There's that sort of drama to it. But am I a Muppet? And that combination of sincerity with ridiculousness is a real gold mine for comedy. And it was curious, that song, because Disney didn't want that song at first. They had another Man or Muppet song they wanted to use, and they got me to produce both, because they didn't like my one. So we produced both songs, and then James Bobin, who directed Concords and directed the Muppets, he likes the song, you know, but we had to convince Disney. We're like, we think this one is going to work great. You know, we're pretty happy with it. And Jason Segel absolutely smashed it out of the park. Sometimes that was one of those sessions where Lee Sklar was on the bass. Was he? Now that I'm thinking back, maybe it was a different bass player on that one. Sorry, I can't remember. But it might have been different. Might have been Beck's bass player, Justin. And but the recording just was like, just kind of, it just was really easy. The song just played itself in a way, and then Jason Segel came in, first take, boom, smashed it out of the park. Like, it was awesome. And so suddenly the song was like, oh, it was good, and suddenly it became, the recording became great, if you know what I mean. Like, Jason made the song. I mean, it doesn't matter how good the song is, if you haven't got a singer that nails it, the song can't work. But he absolutely knocked it out of the park. And then the video, the moment in the film connected really well as well, because it was a sort of song where you've got the stories, it's the characters having a crisis, and the song is the pivot. It felt locked in with the movie, if that makes sense, because sometimes you can write a song and they can just cut it really easily, but that was the character having a crisis, having an epiphany, moving forward, you know, internally. And so there are a lot of things just lined up and it came together really well. It's lucky. Yeah.
Mm, for sure. And that mixture of, I guess, I'd say sincerity and humor, which is really strong on Freak Out City, as I say. As you say, you were kind of allowing some more of that native humor, inherent humor to sort of come to the fore a bit. But at the same time, the album is really, you know, there's a lot of songs on it, like I say, which are very sort of feel quite concerned with what's going on and like, you know, have the feet on the ground in terms of like, you know, this is what's going on around me. This is what I see. And right. Alongside, I guess, the kind of more of the romantic songs. And I guess, as I say, songs about jokes was more explicitly kind of like, okay, this is where we are right now. And do you, I guess I was curious to ask, like, do you feel like both albums together, do these represent like how you feel about, you know, the world and about what's happening right now out there, you know, your general outlook and how you feel at the moment? Do you think they're reflections of that?
Yeah, I think definitely. Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of very much like, the songs are written on these albums. They're often written at home in the evenings or during the day. And I've got three kids and I think with the family, you feel with kids, you think about the world in a slightly different way because you see the future of it and how it's going to impact these people that are very close to you. So the concerns about the world seem very close. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've done a thing recently. I sort of started getting suggestions for songs on Instagram and tried writing a song each week.
Mm.
Didn't go very well because I ran out. I only got through. That was. I thought I'd do it for a whole year, and I managed only 4 weeks. But it was quite fun. People's song suggestions. Like someone sent in a song saying, "What about a song about when your partner watches your favorite TV show without you?" Like, just like, it's been quite fun writing some silly songs like that as well.
Yeah, I guess what was it about it that was it just too tough to maintain? Like a song a week is quite tough, I want to say, right? I mean, like producing that, was it just, or was it people suggesting?
I didn't record them. I just like play them on a piano or guitar. But it was more I wanted to keep I think it's like anything, you know, if you're doing it regularly, it's you just stay kind of match fit.
Mm.
Talk about that a lot with comics. If you're doing gigs regularly, it's a lot easier to do gigs than if you don't do a gig. The longer you don't do it, the harder it is to get back on stage and be like, oh god, you know, get them, warm up the muscles. Yeah,
for sure. Is that partly why you're sort of you're quite keen to get back on the touring sort of scene next year? Because I remember you said earlier that you were planning.
I definitely. I really enjoy it, and I feel like it really nourishes the creative process, because live you can actually try something out quite easily in front of an audience and see if how it goes, and it doesn't matter because it's only one show, you know. It's not like all the effort of recording and releasing it is a bit more. I mean, I guess it's like putting something online, but on social media, but it's a great place to be able to keep trying stuff out and keep yourself fresh. I remember thinking about like some people who tour like 200 days a year, and I used to think they were crazy, but now I'm like, I think it's because in some ways it's easier to just tour a lot or perform to work a lot than it is to stop and start.
So like Bob Dylan, the never ending tour, like he just does it to keep match fit the whole time.
I reckon he probably doesn't know how to not do it.
Yeah, right? He doesn't know how to stop. He doesn't
know. He's been doing over 200 shows a year for decades, right?
Yeah.
I heard he hires the same, we shared a booking agent for a while. Concord's booking agent was the same as Bob Dylan's booking agent in Los Angeles for a few years. And I was always like, what's the story with Bob Dylan? And I think there was some story I heard. I don't know who told me it, but he doesn't stay in fancy hotels, but he books the same. It's like a sort of motel type place. And he just books the same room in each. And it's the end of, you know, the end of the block of rooms. So he can come at one end and stays in that end. Yeah.
Smart. Those are the tricks of the trade, I guess, that you've developed decades of touring. I mean, you mentioned Concords there. I mean, I feel like it would be a little bit miss if I didn't touch on them. Because what's interesting is that when I was researching this interview, I realized that this year, 2025, is the 20th anniversary of the Flight of the Concords, the original BBC radio series, which was
right.
This year it came
out. That's right, because 2005 is when we were in London making that week, because we did Edinburgh 2002 2003 and 2004. Mm-hmm. And then we got the BBC radio show and we moved to London and we spent our days at the BBC office on, is it called Great Portland Street, I think, in London?
I want to say so. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it was this, we couldn't believe it. You know, it was like such an exciting thing. We get in there like, oh, it's quite run down here. Like the building's kind of like, I think they've fixed it up since then, but it was quite a dusty old building. But yeah, we had mini discs. That was the time. And we were really inspired by Christopher Guest and, you know, who, you know, like Best in Show, Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah,
and
those
films were big inspiration to us. And we wanted to sort of try and make our show like that. So we'd improvise the scenes we'd have a template for what has to happen in the scene. And then we would improvise them. But it ended up being ridiculously time consuming because we would just keep doing the scenes. And that's when we first started working with Rhys Darby. Mm. So he played the manager character. Mm. Who in that show was called Brian, I think. And then in the HBO TV show, we changed the name to Murray. Yeah, it was really fun, but we were just so method. I mean, we went to the Tower of London to record a scene where my character's like shooting a bow and arrow straight up in the air and then gets hit. The arrow comes back down and hits me. Like, we're standing outside the Tower of London. It's so unnecessary to be in this location for a radio show. And I don't think it brought anything to the recordings other than lots of time. But it was great because I think we knew, because we'd been offered a TV show, but I think the Mighty Boosh had done a radio show and we could tell that a radio show was going to be far more forgiving on us making our mistakes. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
because
I think Channel 4 had offered us a TV idea, like a pilot maybe, but we took the radio show gig. And yeah, I'm really glad we did, because I think we figured out that manager character, and without that, we wouldn't have got that into the American show, because they would have convinced us to put an American in there, I think. It taught us things that worked and things that didn't work. So that's those are huge wins to figure out before you're filming, where it's super expensive and you can't redo it, you know?
Yeah, and I guess reflecting on the Concords now, like, so now it's been 20 years since the radio show, and then, as I say, set the template for the TV series, and you and Jermaine as the duo that you were, you know, and you guys were and are, you know, massive, you know, in your respective careers and together as the Concords. I mean, what are your sort of feelings and reflections now, looking back on this, now it's been 20 years? I mean, like, how do you feel about the Flight of the Concords now?
Now I'm starting to feel like it's essentially like 20 years. I don't quite know how that happened, how that slipped by, but you know, I've had kids and kids' time just sort of becomes a vortex. But now doing my solo tours, I realize how much the Concord songs and the show means to people, because often they come up to me after my shows and they tell their stories or about the, you know, oh, we met watching Concords, or we got married, you know, we played your song at our wedding, or, you know, the show has a lot of, it's really a big part of people's lives. A lot of people grew up like yourself watching it when they were kids. A lot of people watched it with the show was unusual when it first came out, and that teenagers liked it and the parents liked it. And I think a lot of parents and the teenagers who are now adults, but at the time, a lot of parents came up to me and would say, oh, it's been so great. It's been something that's really brought me and my kid found something to do together. Obviously, none of these things we were just making our show. We had no idea who was going to like it, or, you know, there was not our plan to make a show that different generations would connect with. But so just now it makes me realize, wow, the show's so kind of special for people that it would be, you know, I like the idea of doing some Concords shows, because I think it's not that we're actively doing Concords, really. We don't do it at all. We do a little, we started jamming a little bit this year, trying to write some new songs, but we're not very, it's not our priority, so we're not something we're focused on anymore. So it's a really different time in life for it. But because back then, I mean, we were just living it. We were every day, we would do gigs most nights of the week, during the day, make a radio show. There wasn't much time that Jermaine and I weren't spending together. Mm. And we could finish all of each other's stories. It was hilarious. And and so, yeah, it's such a different time now, but I'm quite fond of looking back on it. I've always been the sort of person who doesn't – I try not to look backwards creatively. I always try to just keep looking forwards and doing new things and keep coming up with new ideas. And I was always a little bit cautious or maybe fearful of looking back, because it felt like, oh, if you start looking back, I think you stop looking forward creatively. So I was always like, oh, I'm not sure I want to look back. I want to keep doing new things. And Concords would always try and, every tour would always try and have some new stuff to do. But right now I think maybe I'm easing off and being so fussed about that, because I think actually the audience just want to hear these old classic songs. And they're not so fussed about, they just want to hear Hippopotamus versus the Rhinoceros. It's not such a bad thing.
I mean, which is a banger, to be fair. I mean, what you just said there reminds me a little bit of, do you know Steve Coogan, the actor, comic actor, Alan Partridge?
I don't know him well, but I've met him a few times. Yeah,
he's amazing. And he talks a lot about how for a long time he felt a little bit like, I think he felt the same way about Alan Partridge. He felt like if he were to return to that character, it would feel a little bit like he was stepping back and he wanted to move forward. He didn't want it to be an albatross. And I think through the work he did on films like Philomena and like the other great comedy work he did, and you know, on stage as well, he was able to sort of come back to Alan, and for him to not feel like it was kind of an albatross. And I feel like I hear a bit some of that as well in what you're saying. If you come back to Concords, I feel like the vibe I get is that it will be for love, but you don't want to feel like it's an imperative. It's like you can go off and do your own thing, like, you know, do free stuff like Freak Out City, and you can, you know, have a blast doing that. But then if you want to, you can go back to Concords as well. You know, there's no imperative there to want to to have to go down.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting that he's had that similar feeling. Maybe it's quite common, but I definitely feel more at ease with the idea of circling back on it. I do think there's something very funny about two old guys singing about too many dicks on the dance floor. So I think Concords in some ways is going to age really beautifully. like some musicians, you know, in gigs, don't age that well. You know, if they say, like, it's very difficult for, you know, an act which is all about dancing on stage and like high energy performance to carry on doing that as an older person. But me and Jermaine have been sitting on stools like a couple of old dudes from the beginning. So anyway, it could be it'd be really fun. We're gonna do a show this coming year, 2026. That'll be quite fun.
Oh, amazing. So you guys will... Oh, incredible. Any kind of... I mean, are you, any plans for where it will be? Will it be New Zealand, or will you be going
overseas? We're going to do a Los Angeles show. There's a festival there. There's a comedy festival there we're going to do a gig at. But we're not committing to a big tour or anything, but we're just sort of... We've been playing a little bit this year, and so we were like, we like the idea of doing some shows, yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, it's great to hear that you guys are still obviously, you know, very close, and like you still obviously hang out and jam, and it's lovely to hear, you know, obviously as a fan.
Yes, but it's amazing how if you both live in, even though we're in Wellington, a small place, like we're often in different countries. Like Jermaine actually travels quite a lot for his work, and then so the common, yeah, it's amazing if you're not focusing on something, it's interesting how much effort it is to make those things happen. Does that make sense? I don't know, but that might be something about just being a bit older, where your life, you're busy with life and you're busy with work commitments, and then we're putting in more effort to try and like spend time jamming. And and it's interesting, sometimes booking a gig I think is the perfect way to make sure things happen.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned something there when you were talking about the Concords and the music you guys did together, in the fact that you don't feel like it is age particularly. And actually, this is something that I wanted to bring up, because I would agree. I think the one of the magical things about the work you guys did together back then, those two albums, is the fact that the music and the comedy, both of them together, have actually aged really rather beautifully. I mean, because what we were talking about earlier...
I think some of it's aged. Some of it hasn't aged as well as other parts. There's some elements I'm not sure you would write now, but a lot of it, I think partly because when we first started touring, we were trying to write very universal type ideas, because we're from New Zealand, we early on write, you know, you might have materialist, you'd have jokes that are very New Zealand specific. And then we'd go to Edinburgh and we'd do this joke that was about the, you know, some thing down the road that people in New Zealand know, but it doesn't work in the UK. So we were like, we cut those jokes. So early on, we started editing our own material so that it would connect in different places. It was all quite surreal and emotional. A lot of the comedy, it's not really political and it's not really topical, that the comedy that we do. So those have helped it age, I think. Yeah,
definitely. And I think, because I think in many ways what you and Jermaine were doing was kind of was riding against the sort of fashions of the day a little bit, because I think when I think back to those comedy shows that I grew up on, that, you know, other than Concord, so things like The Office and Peep Show, it's a lot about UK comedy, I guess, from that time, which was doing really well, which is quite edgy.
So good. Both those shows are so good.
Oh yeah. They're incredible.
Oh, and
but quite edgy. Yeah,
darker. Yeah, much darker and edgy. Yeah. And we were very gentle. But we were playing gigs. Like, I remember, well, Ricky Gervais was just, you know, just ahead of us with his TV show. Like, but because I remember he came and watched our show in Edinburgh and everyone's like, oh my God, Ricky Gervais is here. And he was such a big star. You know, everyone was so excited. It was like whispers. He's in the theater. He's at the back of the venue, you know, and everyone was so jazzed. And, but everyone was really watching all those shows. You were really watching everything about them, The Office, you were watching it, and Peep Show. We met the Peep Show guys around that time as well. And, in fact, I think Sam and Jesse might've written a Concords episode. They wrote Peep Show. I think they wrote one of the first episodes, but, you know, they weren't really in the room, but they wrote an episode, I think. I can't remember, but we were definitely Ian Morris, who worked
Damon
on Peep
Beasley.
Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ian and Damon. They were, Ian was, Ian and Damon worked on one of us. We were very close. All those worlds were very, very close together. Not so much Ricky and Stephen Merchant, but, like you say, you're kind of seeing what they were doing. And then we were like, well, we're not quite like that. We're more in this zone, but you're kind of just nudging slightly away. And then at the same time, there were shows on HBO. There was a big show called Entourage that was on when we were on, and which was about some actors trying to make it in Hollywood, I think. Well, one actor or a star or something, and a manager. Actually had a lot of similarities to Concords, you know, in terms of show business, a manager, an actor, his friends. But it was so different to what we were trying to do. The show, they were living the fast life, you know, live fancy cars, fancy apartments, and then we wanted something that was so that, but by that existing, we were reacting against it. So yeah, all these things around us helped find the path for it.
I've heard you talk before about how when you were working with HBO on Flight of the Conchords, that, like, yeah, Entourage was the big sort of HBO comedy export, and then they kind of left you guys alone. And it's what's fascinating is that both those shows, if you go back to them, like Entourage is a hard watch these days, you know,
because even at the time it had some, they were just quite awful. The characters were quite terrible, like not the actors or anything, but just like they were quite awful people, and the characters, and not in a good way, not in a way that you want to watch, just like, oh, the way they treated people. But a blessing for us is the classic show business story is that HBO was spending a lot of money on that show because they had they were renting helicopters and they were spending lots of money on, you know, if your location is a real divey apartment, it's a lot cheaper to rent to film than it is to rent a mansion in Los Angeles. So HBO was spending so much money making Entourage, they didn't pay any attention to us. It was great. I think that we were just we're the leftover money. They were like, oh, these guys are going to make something that was great. They will fill the half hour. Yeah.
Yeah, and you could kind of do what you wanted, I guess. They left you alone, so you could kind of just do more or less what you wanted.
It was such a blessing. And it's funny, I didn't realize, because that was our first job in Los Angeles, really, the first thing. And we'd made a pilot for NBC. We wrote a script, but that didn't get made. But that was the first thing we'd filmed. And honestly, even Jermaine and I talk about this, ever since, I don't think we've ever worked on anything that had less notes. You know, since then, it's just you get so many notes on everything now, you know, and it was quite amazing that we just didn't really get notes on that show.
Yeah, and it became this huge, you know, this phenomenon. And as you say, you mentioned some of the names there that you worked with, but like, yeah, James Bobin, who you've got on to work with on The Muppets and Dora the Explorer, you know, he was a, you know, a real key figure in the Concords, you know, behind the scenes.
He was really a huge part of it. You know, it's really James, Jermaine and I that were the creators. Yeah, but James was, he really figured out how to turn our sort of, our on-stage show into a, he made it a narrative show. You know, he really helped us figure that out. It's funny watching it now. I was watching it with my kids, have started watching it. And it's at the time it was shot to look vintage. So now it just looks so old. it looks like it's from the 1970s or something. Anyway.
Well, quite a sort of lo-fi camera setup. Yeah, it looks like it was shot like you guys would go out onto the streets and just do it. Like it was quite lo-fi in that sense, but you would just grab moments.
I mean, it was because we often would not have permits. We'd just go out on the street and film. And then the guy was this brilliant producer, Troy, and he had like a Segway thing he was really into. So he would like ride around smoking cigars on his like Segway thing. But also he'd get this Steadicam. You know Steadicam? That kind of like a backpack with a camera on it. So the cameras floats. And so he would do these shots where he'd be riding around on his Segway filming. So the shots are like, whenever you see a shot in that show and it's kind of like a moving, it looks like a real movie shot, a high budget shot, it's actually just this producer cruising around on his Segway holding the camera, getting these, doing like a really expensive shot for free basically with just a Segway. It's really, really good. But yeah, I remember we were filming in a park in Brooklyn and someone goes, is this a student production? We're like, no, this is a TV show, this is an HBO show. it looked like a student short film.
But I think that's such a part of the charm of it. It has such a charm, that show. Like I say, like going against the grain of a lot of sort of comedy shows from that time, which were a bit more concerned of, you know, like political comedy or sort of like shock value comedy. You know, the show has really sort of aged very well, as have the albums, you know, because for the production. There's a real sort of, in fact, I wanted to touch on that because actually right here I have my CD of I Told You I Was Freaky, which was the second album I ever bought. This is my original copy.
No way.
The second album I ever bought. I remember going into HMV in Sheffield and picking that off the stands. And listening to that album a lot. I mean, the long car journeys through sort of on summer holidays through France, where I just, the only company I had were sort of musically was this album and the Prodigy singles. Two very different vibes.
two good options for different energies.
Such different energies. And with, I mean, with this album specifically, because as I say, like, you know, one of the great things about those songs is that the production's quite minimalistic. I mean, you were saying earlier about when you talk about Freak Out City, how on Concords there wasn't too much, it just sounds like there wasn't too much money, so you had to be inventive of what you had, and a lot of the songs were sort of honed over years and years. Like the first album was sort of crafted over a long period of you guys, you know, playing Edinburgh and like the club circuit. And then with this one I want to say was a bit more, you kind of, it spontaneously put together, like this is the soundtrack for season two. So is this kind of in the year between shooting seasons, you and Jermaine sort of put this one together?
It was in the weekend, so we'd film Monday to Friday, and then Saturday, Sunday, we'd write songs and record songs it was crazy. Like we'd be recording them. I remember that song Friends. We needed the song the next week to film. Just knew it had to be a song about friends. And so Saturday morning, just get up and be like, oh God. And then I remember sitting there like writing some little ideas about friends. And then we'd go into the studio Saturday, trying the ideas and then Sunday polishing them up and then mixing it so that we could film it that week. I mean, it was so crazy fast. Yeah. So those songs, I feel like the songs on the second, so the songs on the second season are, I think often they're a little less complex in their structures because we were moving quite quickly. They're often like a kind of A section and a B section maybe in terms of songs, you know, but they connect to the story really well. And that's kind of an interesting lesson about if a song connects to the story, like some of the songs from the first record are pieces that are maybe fully formed. They can exist by themselves. So when we play live, a lot of those songs from that second season are very hard to play live because they're not written for a live show. Whereas the first ones are written, they're like full of jokes and they're structured to play in front of an audience. And then some of the second season ones, they're harder to play live. Like, we've never managed to play that song Friends, which I really love that song. We've never managed to play that live because, you know, like there's a different parts. There's a couple of extra characters in there. And like, anyway, you know, it's interesting.
Is that going to be one that you and Jermaine might attempt? Like, if you, when you sort of, you know, if maybe in Los Angeles when you do the show.
Oh, yeah. If we get Reese, we'll get Reese to show up and Jim Gaffigan to show up. That would be good. That's a good idea. Yeah, that's a good idea. I will see if we'd. I think Jim Gaffigan lives in New York, but that's a very good idea. Yeah.
You can get him on a plane, get him over to the West Coast for the show.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
No, that's, those were written quite quickly. And, but sometimes there's some magic in that as well, you know. I think that one, same girl, the girl with the wonky eye, the wonky eye. That's
We're both looking at a sexy lady. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that one.
Yeah. I was going to ask, do you have like a favorite? I mean, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, so, you know, forgive me for asking it again. But like, do you have a favorite Concord song, or at least a song that you enjoy the most, like playing live or off the album?
I really love playing "The Most Beautiful Girl in the Room" live. Mm. I it's so fun to play. It's like, really, it's fun to play. It's fun to sing. That's what I mean. It's got some different parts to it that make it quite fun to play, like different sections that are all really cool. And then the recording, I'm super fond of Mother Uckers. I feel like Mother Uckers or Inner City Pressure are probably, you know, in the studio, you're trying to capture the energy of the song, and also we were always aspiring to, like, oh, we want it to sound like, you know, the Pet Shop Boys or, you know, Inner City Pressure. We want Mother Uckers. I'm not sure exactly what we were going for, but I feel like the track, I remember we recorded that in New York, and I remember Jimmy Carr, a friend of ours, he was in New York, and he came by our studio to visit, and we just figured out that bass line on the synth, ding, and it was anyway. I feel like Mother Uckers is a really, really banging recording, actually. That's my favorite recording.
It's a phenomenal song. I mean, like, all those songs, like I say, like, that will be, they will be on repeat, you know, on car journeys for me, but that one particularly is, it holds up. And it's funny because you mentioned those sort of like the influences that you guys had, that you guys had on the songs, but not only that, but like what you're aspiring to. So like with Inner City Pressure, it's Pet Shop Boys, and, you know, you have all these different bands that you're clearly such fans of in different genres. Well, when I was on the way here to record this, I was re-listening to Bowie again off the first track album, which is one of my favorite tracks off the first album, Your Tribute to Bowie. And like, that seems to go through like four or five different sort of genres of Bowie eras in the space of like
different Bowie decades.
You've got like Hunky Dory, you've got Let's Dance, you've even got, I think, a little bit of Heaven in there, you've got like a little bit of all this stuff going on. It's like a sort of smorgasbord of like
Let's Dance at the end, right?
So
that was really fun in the studio. Mickey Petralia, he was having a ball. Like, It's quite fun referencing stuff like that. Oh, what do they do? Oh, that snare sound, that's kind of cool. And you just, sometimes just one little element can suddenly make it sound like it's exactly like that period. That Bowie song, you know that the story how we wrote that one? Do you hear that story?
I don't know if I may, Pat, maybe. I'm not
we
sure.
We were driving around Wellington, and there's a radio station in Wellington called Radioactive, which is like the student radio. Which all our friends, you know, I used to work there, everyone's worked there, and they were doing a competition, and me and Jermaine were driving along, and we started phoning in to try and enter the competition, pretending to be David Bowie. Like, so you're like, oh, this is Bowie here. Yeah, want to put my name down to win the free pass to the show. And so then we were just driving along, pretending to be Bowie, laughing away. Then we went back to our flat and just spent the whole day pretending to be Bowie. And by dinner time, our flatmates got back and we'd spent the whole day being Bowie and just singing different bits of, I'm Bowie. Yeah, hey, Bowie. How are you, man? Just talking to each other as Bowie. That song just came from us being goofing around, pretending to be Bowie for a day. And
that's fantastic.
And it's so funny because I love that thing about coming up with, when you're writing comedy and stuff, that moment when you first come up with a funny idea and you're laughing in the room, and what's so curious is that moment is still the thing that is funny on stage, no matter how much time passes. You know, if we sing that song this year or whatever, and So it's 20 years, no more, because this was, I reckon that was in 1998 when we did that, when we wrote that song, 98, 99. Wow. So, and it now, even now, the bit that will make the audience laugh is me and Jermaine going like, hey, Bowie. Hi, man. Like, that's the bit, that the same bit that made us laugh 20 years ago is the bit that's still funny. It's so cool. It's really strange, you know, and the bit you spend all the time, you might spend his time crafting the lyric and a little part that, you think's funny and clever, but the bit that people really laugh at is just me and Jermaine going, Bowie, Bowie.
Yeah. Goofing around. Well, I guess that's the trick, isn't it? Is like, if you can make the person, what something I hear a lot of is with, when it comes to like songwriters or writers and filmmakers, is like, you know, if you make something personal, it has a way better chance of resonating with other people and becoming something universal, rather than if you're aiming for kind of a general sort of thing. So if something that if you land on a joke or even just like a gag or an impression that makes you laugh, there's a way better chance that it will connect and make other people laugh 30 years on. So what I think has happened a lot with the work that you've done.
It's not guaranteed though, because often Jermaine and I would laugh a lot about something, and then we'd perform it live, and no one would laugh. We're like, damn, we thought that was really funny. Turns out that's not that funny at all.
Oh man. Well, I mean, you know, it swings around.
But it's good having like. I think that's one of the benefits of working with other people is you've got like, if you're a stand up by yourself. I think you get better at knowing when you've found something funny, but you don't really know till you test it with a crowd. Whereas I think if you're in a duo or a group, in a writer's room, you know something's funny because the room just starts laughing. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of Bowie, staying on Bowie for a moment. I mean, I don't know if because I guess famously one of your famous sort of appearances that you made on screen is in the Lord of the Rings trilogy as Figwit, the elf in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You're in there a couple of times in First.
That's right.
Ring
and, making these Gollum movies. I'm hoping I'm going to get a return.
As Andy Serkis phones you up, he's gonna be like, right, you know, you're in.
I gotta hit him up, man, on the socials.
Yeah, no, well I mean, I remember you saying once that like if you're from New Zealand, if you live in Wellington, there's like a 90% chance that's you or someone that you know will have been in Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit in some capacity.
Oh yeah. I was sorry, it's just started raining here. I don't know if you're hearing the rumble on the roof, but they did these auditions where they put outlines on the wall, like short, medium height. But short, you audition for a hobbit. Wide and muscly, you're an orc. Tall and skinny, you were an elf. And then you went through the audition. There was hundreds of people going for auditions, and I was like a tall, skinny guy. And so I got put into the elf. Then I had like thin features, you know. So I became an elf. But I saw a video, Jacinda Ardern, the former prime minister, she auditioned for Lord of the Rings. I mean, my dad was in Lord of the Rings. My brother was in Lord of the Rings. Younger brother wasn't in it. It was a lot of men. I'd say most men in New Zealand were in it. There's not that many female roles in those books.
Well, I remember there was a when they were casting the Riders of Rohan for Two Towers. I think like they ran out of men. They ran out of male extras, so they had to draft in sort of to play the riders, the guys on the horses. They had to draft in like loads of women, you know, who were incredible riders to dress them up in fake beards and everything. Yeah. You know, because we've gone for all the men. They used to get
That's right. And they also got the New Zealand Army. Did you hear that story? So
I think
orcs. They just got the army. It's like the New Zealand army are out in the desert dressed as orcs. It's so crazy. That it was a really cool time because the whole country was really involved and supportive and proud of it. It was it was a really cool time because it was the first big movie really that was made here, and it brought the whole country together, but it was quite hilarious that the army was, you know. You know, being orcs, yeah.
Yeah, but did you know that that Bowie, like I say, mentioning Bowie, like
yeah, what's your secret to Bowie?
He auditioned for Elrond. He went up for Elrond. There's like a video. I remember Billy Boyd who played Pippin. Yeah, Billy Boyd or Dominic Monaghan, who played one of the hobbits, was in a casting
crazy.
Room. Yeah, and then Bowie just comes in.
I would have got to hang out with him.
Yeah, because you have that scene in The Hobbit, right? With you, it's you and Hugo Weaving as your
yeah.
You know,
I became
you're in Rivendell.
Quite good friends with me and Hugo Weaving. Got to hang out quite a lot. I mean, I love Hugo, but Imagine if that was me and Bowie hanging out on set.
can you imagine?
That would have been so cool. No. Oh, man. Yeah, I feel that's one of my big regrets. I never got to see Bowie perform and never got to meet him, but never got to see him perform. I always just thought I'd get a chance. Yeah, it was a bummer. Yeah, really sad. I heard Baz Luhrmann, I was talking to Baz Luhrmann one time. He's an Australian, legend Australian director, and he was really good friends with David Bowie, and he'd told him about our Bowie song. Yeah. And Bowie was not, she was like, what is this thing? He wasn't sure about it, and Baz Luhrmann was like, you should check it out, it's really good, you'll like it.
Yeah.
So I think Bowie might have seen the Bowie song, but we never connected, sadly. Yeah.
Well, that is a shame. I mean, because I was going to ask if whether you guys had connected or met. I mean, Bowie was a huge comedy fan as well. He loved, I think he spent from the 90s onwards, he was really keyed into British comedy and sort of global comedy. So I'm sure he would have been a fan of if he had heard the song, at least he would have been like, oh, that's really, really cool how they've done that.
Yeah. Or maybe it was just too close to home. Maybe it was
you nailed him too well.
I think he was an extra, wasn't he, with Ricky Gervais? It was really great. And no, I do. That's what I mean. I feel like we were really close to. I felt like it was just a matter of time, and we were going to cross paths. It didn't happen. I'm so gutted that I've never heard that story about him auditioning for Elrond. That would have been insane, because he would have been in Wellington hanging out. Literally, we would have been going out for dinner. We could have done a duet with Bowie.
Well, didn't you? I remember hearing you say that when you were working on The Hobbit with Ian McKellen and Hugo Weaving and all these great actors, you guys were just be jamming, kind of riffing in between takes,
On The Hobbit, we were so. Both Hugo and Ian are super cool people, and there's a lot of waiting around on set, and we were in one room. They had this crazy rig, had two studios running at the same time, this camera that's on this. Peter Jackson always has the fanciest machines making the doing the shots, very different to a Segway, and and two rooms. One room is full of the actors playing the dwarves, and all the sets bigger, but exactly the same set, and another room, normal size set, with me, Ian McKellen, Hugo Weaving, and a few of the elves, I guess. But the two things have been filmed at once, and they get put over the top of each other. So it looks like we're in the same room, and there's two cameras moving at exactly the same time. So you can have a camera that moves. It's so fancy, but also so slow. Like this, I can't remember the name of the machine they had, but basically, it was just the overtime machine, because we would wait there for hours while they got these two cameras to move at exactly the same speed. And in that time, we were waiting around, me and Ian McKellen and Hugo Weaving just started making, we were laughing about the idea of Lord of the Rings, the musical. And so we were writing songs as we were, I can't remember, we were just laughing away, giggling away. And then Peter Jackson calls, okay, and action. And then we start doing the scene, we have to walk in, and we're meant to be really serious. And Ian McKellen's starts without moving his mouth. He's I can't remember what we were singing about, but it's like, oh, 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 with the dinner of elves, suddenly, we just start losing it. I mean, it's the best thing. It's so fun laughing when you're not allowed to laugh. It's like being at school, or you don't get that much as an adult, but we were in hysterics trying to be serious, and then Peter Jackson yells cut, because he's like, can the elves please get their shit together? Because we're all giggling. So funny, man. It was so good. Anyway, but yeah, imagine if that was Bowie. Imagine if that had been Bowie and Ian McKellen and I. But Hugo, to be fair, Hugo Weaving's so good.
He's a legend.
Another legend.
You mentioned something there about how laughing when you're not supposed to is the sweetest kind of laughter, and I totally agree. It's when there's a sort of social impetus, whether it be or a professional one, if you're on set, where you're not supposed to be laughing, but you can't help but just crack up. It reminds me, I think the closest I can get to that in day-to-day life is if I'm listening to a podcast, or if I'm listening to a comedy show and I'm out and about and I'm walking around central London.
You might crack up and you sort of catch yourself you're sitting on the train or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got to really hold it in, because if you're on public transport, you don't want to, you don't want to seem like a lunatic, but you're saying you're just corpsey inside,
it's that feeling of, if you've got someone in the, like you say, if you're at a work environment where there's a someone who's the boss and you're not, you're supposed to be concentrating and people start laughing, that is just so good. But then I guess that's like a teacher or a boss, whatever, whoever, but yep, funny times. Yeah, really good.
Do you ever get that, I guess, in the studio, I guess, like, do you have a lot of laughs when you're on the job, like in the studio? Is it quite a fun, you know, like,
environment? Oh, yeah, yeah, studios. Yeah, studio's fun. The musicians are always really funny. And actually, there's a bit of, it's that situation where there's a little bit of pressure. So you kind of, oh, actually, one of the recent times where I had that feeling that we're talking about was when we were recording the song. There's a song on there kind of called Freak Out City, which is the name of the album, but it's called Rabbit Hole. And we had nine of us in the room recording together. And weirdly, I was singing and I turned my head and my cap fell off and knocked the microphone. It sort of went like, but you're in the middle of a take and you've got nine people and everyone's trying to do their best. We know the recording's good, so you're like, keep going because we don't want to ruin this take. But Moana and Iris saw me do this insane cap microphone sort of thing, which was just so super clumsy, kind of Mr. Bean situation in the studio. And then they started laughing, then I started laughing, and then the guitarist looking over like, what's happening? Why are they laughing? And then the whole track just sort of, we're doing our best to try and keep playing the music through the laughter, but it just unraveled and eventually a minute, you know, it collapsed to us. And so that was a right, we abandoned that take. But yeah, that was that feeling where you're trying your best not to laugh because you don't want to ruin everyone else's great performance. Do you know what I mean? And you're in the same room so that you can't make the noise. There's a lot of pressure not to make the sound. Yeah, that was really funny, actually.
Iris and Moana, the two backup singers.
They're the singers. The you saw them at the Rough Trade in store.
They were great. They were having a good. They seemed like so they were having a good time.
Good. Yeah, they're really great singers, and so they've done all the shows, and they're on a lot of the record. They do all the harmonies and vocals in the record. They're really cool. Yeah.
Fantastic. No, they were, I loved the performances you guys gave on the tour, but also, Rough Trade West, where like I say, it has that spontaneous kind of infectious energy to it, both the album and the live performances, which is lovely to see. And speaking of people who, like, I guess, like collaborators, because something that we ask on the, on Half the Picture, we ask all our guests is, because we get like a lot of filmmakers on and like musicians as well and writers, I mean, and people who are very sort of keyed in and passionate about, you know, what's going on out there in like the sphere of like, music or film or what have you. Out of interest, is there anyone out there working right now who you haven't worked with before, an actor, writer, musician, director, who you'd love to work with? Like, is there someone out there now who's kind of firing you up and getting you excited about what's going on and that you'd like to work with potentially?
I've always been a big fan of Wes Anderson. You know, I feel like Wes Anderson was rocking before we started doing our things, and was a huge influence on me and Jermaine and Taika, and he was sort of our hero. And I guess he's probably 10 years older or something, or he was already making films. I think he was making them in the 90s. Bottle Rocket was in the 90s.
Rushmore, yeah.
Right. So those are all, again, those are huge. They're a big influence on our stuff. So he's had a big impact. I think he's probably had the biggest impact. So honestly, if there was ever a chance to collaborate with him, I would definitely make it happen. Because it's just really, he's got such an amazing style that was, you know, his thing that's really influenced cinema, you know, and TV, and everyone's influenced the whole generation. So he's probably the big film person I'd like to work with. And yeah, that's probably one of my big heroes. Yeah.
Amazing. I think you've got a shot at that personally, because I feel like because for what I know of Wes, I mean, like, he seems very keyed into, like, you know, the obviously being an incredibly funny person and filmmaker himself, I feel like he's very keyed into comedy and you know, just generally music, like, obviously having worked with Mark Mothersbaugh on from Devo on his soundtracks, and
Mark Mothersbaugh did some work on the Minecraft movie, and Mark did that. So I met Mark. He's so cool. What a genius. He's like, he has a studio in Los Angeles that's this weird, used to be a cosmetic surgery building. And it's this green building. It's called Mutato Studios. And it's this, like, it looks like something from a sci-fi movie. So his studio is like octagonal and it's full of like this cool desk. And it's all like, it looks like you're in Star Trek and he's there making his music. And he's got all these cool old synths. And he's an absolute bonkers genius, that guy. Anyway, he was telling me, I was like, what was it like doing the Wes Anderson films? You know, because I was curious because I'm a big fan of Wes Anderson. And he was just telling me cool stories about him coming up with ideas and, Wes Anderson really being into getting the music, having music as he's making the movie. So he's listening to music while he's writing it, but also having music ideas that maybe affect how he films it. Mm. Do you see what I mean? Rather than putting music on all the end, there's a bit of a collaboration going on at the same time. So Mark would sometimes come up with ideas and send them to Wes Anderson, and that might be something that he was like, oh, that could be good for a sequence. And then I love that, you know, that bit in it's Life Aquatic, you know, the submarine sequence and that cool, that music, honestly, and again, that's a real sort of, that really influenced us, me and Jermaine, when we were like, we all loved that. Like, wow, the music just felt like it made that scene magic, right?
Where the camera's going through, giving you a little tour of the submarine. Yeah, I love that scene.
Yeah, it's like, boop, 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 boop. It's this little synthy thing. And anyway, really, really cool. Mark Mothersbaugh, what a guy. Yeah, he's awesome.
Incredible. I'd even go so far as to say he's a little underrated. I mean, I think I don't think he's ever not been great. You know, I mean, all the music is produced with Devo and then, you know, with Wes, you know, sat working on soundtracks and even worked with Taika on Thor Ragnarok.
Right. He's done a couple of things with Taika and he's so productive. It's insane how much music that guy's created. But I know what you mean. He is a really big deal, but he's maybe not as well known as, he's done a lot more music than maybe people realize on TV and film.
100%. He's been so prolific for so long and people definitely know him and his work, but like, I feel like sometimes they could shout it from the rooftops a little bit more. He's just great.
Because we worked on the Minecraft thing, we had a dinner and we were talking about, was all the music team were in Wellington. They came to Wellington and they recorded the orchestra here. And we were chatting away and we were talking about some documentary. We were talking about documentaries we like. Have you seen that one about Klaus Kinski, the My Best Fiend? Have you seen that one?
The Herzog.
I was like, yeah, this is one of my favorites. You should watch that. And then someone was talking about some other documentary. And then Mark Mothersbaugh goes, oh, I think I've seen that. What is that one? And then he goes, oh, yeah, you know, I did the music for that. Like, he's done so many things that he doesn't even remember doing the music for a whole movie. It's like, yeah, he's done hundreds of movies. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think about John Williams, all those composers as well, who've done like hundreds of movies, or even like, I remember
John Williams is interesting. Like, when John Williams is next level, even in the music world, he's on another stratosphere. Like, when I got to go to the Academy Awards, they have drinks for the music department, all the music people. So nice. And it's like the music, the head of the Music Academy's house, and it's this nice house sort of, and we're all there having drinks and it's super chill. It's so different to the actors it's just not like the music people in movies are so just way more grounded, you know, because they're all behind the scenes. So they're just like really lovely people, and you have to be a nice person pretty much to be able to work, because you got to work with people. And John Williams was there, and I just was talking to different composers and different musicians, and you could tell when they introduced John Williams for his little, he got an award, that he is, and amongst composers, John Williams is so highly regarded. It's like he's a different creature. He's so good. I mean, he's very old now, but like, even all the composers that were there were like, whoa, he's something else, you know, all the great composers who do films. And then there's John Williams, who's like a different kind of league.
Yeah, and he's been going, and he's still going. Like, he's in his 90s now, and he's still doing it. I mean, that's the remarkable thing. I mean, that's kind of when you know that he's doing what he loves, you know what I mean? Like, and he's just, and he's just not going to stop, you know?
Yeah, that was just cool. I remember that moment going, Yeah, he is good, isn't he? Because then you listen to, you know, Indiana Jones or something, you're like, oh yeah, Star Wars, you're like, holy shit, it's good, man. The music's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you say hi to him at that event? Was it one of those kinds of things?
It was one of those ones. There's a big room of different people, but yeah, it was a really special thing to get to go to. That was cool.
So I guess it's just, and this is just like a general question, but as at the time of recording this, it's, you know, 15th of December, you know, Christmas is around the corner and 2026 is coming down the pipe. I mean, do you have any sort of like hopes or goals for 2026 or any resolutions? Are you a New Year's resolutions kind of guy?
New Year's resolution, which I tried last year, was to write a new song each week. I think I might just try it again because I liked the idea of it, but I just didn't manage it. What else? I'm building a music studio in Wellington, and I'm going to finish it. I'm aiming to have it ready by June, so I'm quite excited about getting a new creative space for writing and recording. So it's kind of a buzzy year for me in terms of, I've got a lot of films that look like they're coming to life this year in the production. They won't be coming out this year. They won't be coming out. They'll be coming out in the next 4 years. But for me, the songwriting part is I do the songwriting at the front end of these movies. So it's looking like quite a fun year actually for songwriting.
Fantastic. And then of course, as you say, you know, you've got that show with Jermaine. And then you're planning to come back. Are you coming back to like America and the UK to do a bit more touring as well? Is that on the cards or?
It's not locked in yet, but yeah, I'm hoping to bring the band back over. It'll have to be the second half of the year. Yeah. Just some more shows. I mean, it's so fun. I had a great time in London, and I thought, wow, I really want to try and do a tour on trains around the UK doing the shows and just travel by train to all the towns. Hoping to get that on the books. Yeah. Get that planned up. Yeah.
Well, hey, I mean, if you do come back to London, if that ends up happening, I'll be there because, you know, like I say, I've been a fan of yours for years, and I love the work you do, and I'm so chuffed that you were so generous with your time to come on the pod today. So
pleasure, man. Thanks so much. I'm glad we got this to work out. That's really cool.
Yeah, me too. And like I say, I can't wait to see what you've got got coming out, you know, in the next year. And yeah, just big fan. So thanks so much
thanks
for coming
much.
On the pod, Brad. This was so much
fun. All right, yeah. Cool, man. All right. Thanks, Ace.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Brett McKenzie. Remember to like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And stay tuned for more exciting interviews and guests coming soon on Half the Picture.